welcome to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York, on the unceded homelands of the Mohican people, who are known today as the Stockbridge-Munsee community. I'm Andrea Cunliffe.
And I'm Jacob Boston. Today on the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, we begin by asking United Tenants to give us an update on repairs at the Schuyler Apartments in the south end of Albany. Then, we look at the Housatonic River Initiative and the ongoing struggle for environmental justice. Later on, we bring you more coverage from the Capitol Roots workers and their Fight to Unionize rally. After that, we hear from the Braver Angels, which brings different political viewpoints together and respectful communication. Finally, we talk to the Connect Center about the Adopt the Taco event, food insecurity, and more. But first, here are the headlines.
A federal judge has dismissed the $8 million civil rights lawsuit filed by the Democratic Commissioner of the Rensselaer County Board of Election relating to a 2009 ballot fraud probe. The judge found no evidence that Special Prosecutor Trey III fabricated evidence in the investigation of Commissioner Edward McDonald Jr., who was acquitted of the charges filed against him.
Former Governor Cuomo is suing the state attorney general over her refusal to pay his legal fees to defend him in a federal claim filed by a state police investigator who accused him of sexually harassing and inappropriately touching her. The female trooper's lawsuit, who was filed against the state police and former secretary to the governor, Melissa DeRosa, whose legal fees in the trooper's lawsuit are being paid by the state.
The state will begin receiving applications on August 25th from individuals from people interested in opening retail dispensaries under the conditional adult use retail dispensary license category. Under this category, individuals must both document a prior conviction for marijuana and that they have operated a business that turned a profit for at least 2 years.
The Centers for Disease Control is dropping the recommendation that Americans quarantine themselves if they come into close contact with an infected person. It also said people no longer need to stay at least 6 feet away from others. The changes come now that an estimated 95% of Americans, 16 and older, have acquired some level of immunity, either from being vaccinated or infected. The average number of reported COVID-19 cases and deaths have relatively been flat this summer, at around 100,000 cases a day and 300 to 400 deaths. That's it for the headlines.
And first up, residents of Schuyler Apartments in the south end of Albany are having problems getting needed repairs done. Kenyon Ryan of United Tenants discusses their efforts to assist tenants there and elsewhere in Albany. This is with Mark Dunley.
We're joined by Kenyon Ryan, who is Executive Director of United Tenants of Albany, a decades-old group in Albany working to protect tenants' rights. And I saw recently that they become active helping out some tenants at the Schuyler Apartments in the south end of Albany who have been having some problems with the landlord. So, Kenyon, why don't you give us your 20-second intro into United Tenants and then, you know, what's going on with the Schuyler Apartments?
Sure. Thank you for having me. Like you said, United Tenants is almost 50 years old. I've been in this role for about 4 months, but I've been working here for over a year. We do rental assistance, tenant court, law advocacy, work on policies, and just try and benefit tenants as much as we can in the county of Albany. Schuyler Inn Apartments, it's 69 Trinity Place, is probably how I'll refer to it mostly, just because that's its address, and I think it's also the name of the LLC. Is owned by Asaf Al-Kayyam, who's the leader of Jerusalem Management Group. They're a huge property holder in the city of Albany and pretty famously slummy, I would say. Really don't take care of their properties, and a lot of tenants, whether they're in the quote-unquote college ghetto or South End or West Hill, all have the same complaints, being property management annoying or harassing them, the property falling into disrepair, landlord's a jerk, et cetera.
And so I understand they're actually trying to form a tenant union at this point. Are some people engaged in a rent strike yet?
Yeah, so not a rent strike. Well, not there are individuals engaged in a rent strike because, you know, as a tenant, if repairs aren't being made, you're within your right to withhold rent until those repairs are made. It's a warranty of habitability concern, and it falls under the real property law. There's no large scale rent strike. It's all individual, which is really difficult and can kind of put a household at in a really in a position of vulnerability, I guess is how I'd say it. We are exploring developing a tenant association there. We did it at Bleecker Terrace most recently. It was about a 3-month campaign. We were able to come to an agreement with management that includes no rent increases more than 5%. Every tenant is entitled to a lease. And it's essentially a hyper-localized good cause. I don't know if that's going to be the response that, or I guess the solution that we're trying to reach at Trinity. The issues that tenants at Trinity seem to be coming against is it's largely repair and maintenance issues, as well as problems with the personnel involved at Jerusalem Management Group. So we'll see what the end result is. Right now, we're still in the formulating phase, and I've made contact with about 20% of the tenants at Trinity right now.
Now, I remember when this is an old school building, I believe. Is that correct?
Yeah.
And so I remember when that was first converted, you know, that was actually, you know, something new for the that particular community. You know, what has been their long-term, you know, reputation in the neighborhood?
Well, so the apartments are actually beautiful, which is nice. I mean, you know, I went in there just last week, was talking to a few tenants, and a lot of them welcomed me into their homes and were showing me all of the repair issues. And they're beautiful apartments. They're just not taken care of. It seems like the most previous management, a lot of tenants have nostalgia for. I don't know if they were that different than Jerusalem Management Group, because a lot of the issues that I'm seeing seem to be decades old, like windows falling out. You can't raise windows. A lot of leak issues. So I don't know how different it used to be, but considering the affordability of the sizable apartments in there, it's a really nice property. And it's a shame that, you know, Asaf and Jerusalem Management are trying to turn it into like this Airbnb paradise where almost 6 of the apartments are now vacant Airbnbs. Historically, it's an affordable apartment building, and it's just becoming hyper-commodified like the rest of the student housing.
You know, just looking back, you know, my suspicion was when they did that conversion, perhaps they were looking to sort of gentrify the neighborhood and, you know, basically get higher rents and increase property value. And, you know, the South End, the city has continued a century of disinvestment. What has been their response so far to, you know, to the concerns, particularly the articles in the Times Union outlining some of the concerns? You know, have they come in and said, oh, I'm sorry, thanks for bringing this to my attention, let me get right on it? Or is it just an ongoing struggle?
Yeah, it's a little bit of that. I mean, I'm pretty sure right after the article came out, or if not a little before, which I imagine he had the idea that something might be in the works, Asaf put the building up for sale. For about 11 million, maybe 11.9. When I was there with some tenants who I had been working with that were facing eviction for withholding rent, you know, the property management team was, some of them were really nice and down to earth and generally new. And then the older staff or like the supervisor of the building, they gave off a really like frustrated and angry vibe about all of the apartments that I was walking in. I don't think that they liked me being there, of course, but it's not like I was soliciting anything. So they couldn't really tell me to leave. I had an agreement that I was going to be there for some repairs made for one tenant who didn't feel safe with, you know, 3 men in her apartment. So I would say they're fainting, you know, responsiveness, but there's still issues. And I'm still getting emails every day from tenants like, I don't, you know, I scheduled this code repair, or like code enforcement is supposed to come and review my apartment. They haven't come. The supervisor still hasn't fixed the AC. one of them, their window just flew out. They told management. Management said, just don't open the window for now. And it's like the window flew out of its sockets because of the wind. Like, that's not something that you can just put back up and say, just don't open the window for right now. So it's a mixed bag.
So you have mentioned code enforcement. You know, what is code enforcement's role in this? And have they, you know, been generally responsive to concerns?
I would say they've been generally responsive. I don't want to like come after code enforcement too hard because I know that there's a lot of need in the city. But, you know, when a building like this gets such attention and then they fail to show up at inspections, I don't know if it's a capacity issue or if they just don't really care, or maybe they've already worked with a lot of these tenants. But, you know, I have access to all of the code violations in the building up till today, and it's not like they're slowing down. So I feel bad for the tenants that call code enforcement, come to agreements on dates. Code enforcement never comes. The property management doesn't take care of the issue. And when it's 97 out and you can't open your windows, you don't have AC. So that kind of stuff is really frustrating because it's code's responsibility to hold ASAF and Jerusalem management accountable. And if they're not able to meet the demand of the city, something needs to be done on their end so that they can actually ensure tenants don't fry in their apartments, which is getting to be an actual concern, in my opinion. Like, if tenants can't open their window and it's a danger to even be near the window and they don't have AC, what do you do in this heat? So we're lucky there's been a break this week because it's been pretty tough in there for some tenants.
We mentioned earlier the possibility of a tenants union. What does that involve, and how's that coming, or is it proceeding?
Yeah, so I've met with, like I said, about 10 tenant households, which considering what the Airbnb is, but the Airbnb to total unit rate is, I'd say it's about 20% of the tenants. A lot of them are interested. An issue that always happens in these kinds of situations is the long-term tenants say, I can't do this anymore. I'm just going to leave. And so it's a little different than at Bleecker Terrace, where we didn't have such an overbearing management. I mean, it was tough. They pulled a gun out on the tenants, but at the same time, those tenants were there to stay. A lot of them had lived there longer than I've even been alive. Whereas at Trinity, it's like 2-year tenants. They're just saying, you know, well, they just don't make repairs. So trying to get them invested in the building is part of the struggle. But I would say any tenant who's been there for more than 3 years has expressed a lot of interest because they've seen what ASAF and Jerusalem Management have done to the building, and they want it back to the way it was, which, like I said, it could just be nostalgia, but the tenants are entitled to their rights. And if another property management company or if the tenants union is able to get the property management to make repairs, then I'm all for it.
So we've been talking with Canyon Ryan, United Tenants of Albany. Canyon, if people want more information or get help from United Tenants, how best to contact you?
You could call us at the hotline. That's 518-436-8997. You could always go to the website, which is utalbany.org. And my email is canyon, C-A-N-Y-O-N, at unitedtenantsalbany.org.
Thank you very much, Canyon. And this has been Mark Dunley for the Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
Find more housing justice stories on our website, mediasanctuary.org.
Grassroots environmental activists in New York State have been fighting for decades to stop and clean up toxic waste dumping by General Electric and other industrial polluters. These local struggles against multinational corporations have global consequences because the same business practices has contaminated the environment worldwide. One of these places is in western Massachusetts, less than 50 miles from the New York State Capitol. Hudson Mohawk Magazine correspondent Steve Pierce speaks to Tim Gray, executive director of the Housatonic River Initiative, about their ongoing struggle for environmental justice.
The 200 miles of the Hudson River between Glens Falls and New York City constitute one of the nation's most contaminated hazardous waste sites. A major reason is that General Electric and other industrial polluters dumped millions of pounds of PCBs and other toxins into the water for many years. It wasn't just the Hudson River. The same companies are responsible for polluting water around the world. The grassroots environmental activists who sounded the alarm continue their decades-long struggle to raise awareness and hold the polluters accountable. I'm Hudson Mohawk Magazine correspondent Steve Pierce, and I spoke to one of them.
My name is Timothy Gray. I'm the executive director of the Housatonic River Initiative. Well, we're a group that formed back around 1992 to try to make General Electric accountable for the pollution of the Housatonic River. And then as we started that movement to try to do that, we found ourselves up in the city of Pittsfield with finding out that General Electric had given away contaminated fill all over the place, and that our county was a true sort of like an ecological disaster thanks to General Electric.
The Housatonic River is located where?
It's located in western Massachusetts, kind of goes along the border between Albany and Massachusetts, goes down through Connecticut into Long Island Sound. And so likewise on the Hudson, where all the PCBs in the Hudson went down into Long Island Sound, all the PCBs in the Housatonic also go to Long Island Sound.
How did the issue come to light?
The issue came to light from many, 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 many years of pushing the issue. I go back to 1976 when I took the first samples in the river on a college project, and we were told we didn't know what we were talking about, and our data was no good, and it ended up that our study was accurate. And then the way the EPA finally admitted that there were PCBs in the Housatonic is that they found them in the milk supply in Connecticut, in the stores, and they traced it back to a farm here in Berkshire County.
Why should people who live outside of the immediate area of the Housatonic River care about this?
Well, because this is a story where our community has gotten slammed and slammed and slammed for many, many years by General Electric. And we've been fighting all these different, you might say, spider legs of the story that go off in different directions. You know, again, we started to try to get our river cleaned up, but then we find out that there's contaminated homes all over the city of Pittsfield, and we expose that. We force them into testing, you know, close to 300 homes, and a large percentage of them had to be excavated and cleaned out. And we believe there's still a whole lot of homes up in the city of Pittsfield, and that they need to be addressed. So this project has been going on for 25, 30 years now, and there still seems to be no end to it.
Is this a unique story for the area you're in, or does it happen other places?
Well, you know, we have been in contact with many PCB sites through the years. In fact, we held one of the first PCB conferences in the United States. And so we've been in contact with other communities that are like Pittsfield, but Pittsfield is definitely, you know, probably one of the worst in the nation as far as the types and the amount of PCB contamination that has been put into not only the river, but into the homes and all over Berkshire County, our dumps, everything.
Can you give us just a very quick snapshot of what PCBs are and how they ended up in the water?
Yeah, well, PCBs are called polychlorinated biphenyls. They're a chlorinated hydrocarbon chemical, which puts them in a class of chemicals that are known to be extremely dangerous, poisonous for us. And GE here on the Housatonic, along with the Hudson and other places that GE's been involved with, were plowing these things into the river for many, 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 many years. And of course, they're very toxic. And, you know, we have years and years and years of reports about the Housatonic River, where the ecological health of the river is very compromised, and the human health along the river has been compromised, too. So this is a chemical that we need to take heed of. It's why they're cleaning up PCBs around the world, pretty much, because they are known to be one of the worst chemicals on the face of the earth.
You're listening to Tim Gray, Executive Director of the Housatonic River Initiative on the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Steve Pierce.
We are making progress. You know, we forced them into cleaning up 2 miles of the river in Pittsfield. Again, you know, hundreds of homes we forced them into clean up. They had to clean up many businesses around Pittsfield. The trouble is we, you know, it's still kind of like the tip of the iceberg what we believe is out there. We found a lot of stuff, but boy, GE was giving it all over the place, and we believe it's still throughout Berkshire County, and actually even over towards your way In New York State, we know that PCBs from Pittsfield ended up in Nassau, New York, places over near Troy. And so their legacy continues on of dumping this chemical to unbelievable amounts. We were able to prove when we got started way back in 1992, the EPA and the DEP, Massachusetts DEP, were telling us that there was 46,000 pounds of PCBs in the river. And then we did interviews with high-level GE managers, and they came to us and said, you know, that 40,000, you know, figure that GE is using, it's more like 1.5 million pounds. And that's only what that we can account for from lossage from the plant on a daily basis. It didn't account any of the midnight dumping that was going on for years and years and years.
So presumably, if General Electric and others, I imagine, were dumping PCBs into the water, they must have thought that there was nothing harmful about it at the time. Is that right?
Well, they like to say that as their PR move, but we have documents. I mean, one of the earliest documents is from 1936 from the Harvard School of Public Health. It was a published paper after they had a conference on, at the time they called them Halowax, which was PCBs back in 1936. And at this conference that they, again, they had a conference between, you know, the conference attendees, and they basically had two General Electric vice presidents admitting that the people were getting sick in their plants. And this was 1936. So they knew way, way back when. And then there's memos throughout the year that not only GE knew, but Monsanto knew, the whole group of them knew that this stuff was bad and that it was going to be causing all sorts of lawsuits in the future.
It sounds like painstaking progress step by step. Where are you at now?
Well, where we're at now is that, see, back in 2016, we had a permit that was going to take it out into the desert, something like that. And people were sort of rallying around that permit. And then GE didn't like that permit because it was going to cost them a lot of money to take it out of town like they did on the Hudson River. And so they sued. And before we know it, our community is targeted for a dump. And, you know, this dump, the world-renowned geologist that's working for us says it's probably the textbook example of where you would never put a dump, yet the EPA, the DEP, and General Electric seem, you know, bent out of shape about making sure that we have this dump in our community. And we're not taking any of it here in the town of Lee, which is where they want to dump it. And we have risen up against it. Now, this dump was voted in by 5 people in Berkshire County. That's it, just 5 people. And then none of the towns got a vote on this dump. It was all hidden behind our backs. There was never a vote. It was the most undemocratic thing you've ever seen in your life.
So what are you going to do about it?
Well, we're doing a lot of things. We're in federal court on an appeal. Waiting to go against EPA and GE. In that thing, we have a local lawsuit going after our selectman in our town who signed on to this agreement behind our backs and never told us. We also have a Board of Health initiative going on, trying to get the Board of Health to rule that this dump will be terrible for the health of the people in Lee. And then we're just doing what, you know, every other citizen in our position does, is fight for our town, our lives, and to try to stop as much of this PCB shenanigans that are going on as we can.
And what can people do to help out?
We have a GoFundMe page under the Housatonic River Initiative, and you can find us. Our website is clean, thehousatonic.com. And we have lots of writings and commentary that we've been putting on that for over 20 or 30 years to tell the whole story. Lots about it. So it's a good resource for people that want to learn a little bit more about it. But we're fighting for our lives.
That was Tim Gray, Executive Director of the Housatonic River Initiative. For the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, I'm Steve Pierce.
That was Steve Pierce talking with Tim Gray about the Housatonic River Initiative.
And for those of you just tuning in, I'm Andrea Cunliffe.
And I'm Jacob Boston. You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network on WOOCLP 105.3 FM Troy, WOOGLP 92.7 FM Troy, WOOSLP 98.9 FM Schenectady, and WOOALP 106.9 FM Albany. This program comes from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York.
And if you like what you hear, you can support this program by telling a friend. Find today's stories and more at mediasanctuary.org.
The Capital Roots workers and their fight to unionize rally occurred at their Urban Growth Center at Troy. Roaming labor correspondent Willie Terry reports on the event.
Strike in Alabama against a company called Warrior Met, and the National Labor Relations Board just ruled against the union the day before yesterday. It gets worse. Hold on a second. They ruled that the company has lost $16.5 million during the strike and that the union has to pay that money to the company. If that stands, all strikes will be essentially outlawed, because if you go on strike and you owe your employer whatever they lose in the strike, it's basically making strikes illegal. There's a reason I'm saying this to you. The battle here today, the battle at other not-for-profits, the battle at big for-profits like Amazon and Starbucks, the battle to feed working people like we've been doing for the last 2 years, the battle for housing, the battle against racism and sexism and the oppression of the LGBT community, all of those things are tied together. And if we do not start winning some of these things, we lose them. I have 3 brand new grandchildren. I am fighting for my grandchildren, because 20 years from now, I'll be a picture on the mantle, but they will be inheriting the world that we give them today. So the only way we can do this is with union worker solidarity and human solidarity. But I want to say one more thing. We have to do that with all of our intelligence, with all of our experience, with all of our abilities. We can't do it crazy. We got to do it organized. We have to work together, and we have to keep our eyes on the prize, a union in every single workplace.
Mark, I'm a nation, everybody. Prayer for us.
Mark is right about other nonprofit workers in Troy. This is not the only nonprofit that is organizing. I want to give a shout out to John Conlon from the Joseph Sasson Shelter Organizing Committee. They're voting right now to organize first Capital Roots, then Joseph's House. More are coming. Nonprofit workers are fed up. We are not going to let these nonprofit organizations in Troy and the Capital District hide behind mission statements and then not actually perform them. That won't stand. No more.
Willie Terry, Roman Labor Correspondent. Still here at the Capital Roots Rally on River Street. And I have as my guest Jay. And Jay is with the union drive at Joseph House, in which they're doing the same thing that Capital Roots is doing, trying to get a union in their workplace.
Yeah.
And how you doing, Jay?
I'm doing well, man. How are you?
All right.
So,
Jay, what's the latest on y'all struggle?
Yeah, so over at Joseph's House, what's happening right now is the mail-in election is taking place. So on the 27th of July, last week, the ballots were sent out by the NLRB. We've been receiving them and sending them back out. And I'm not sure how far we can get into this, but we can say that it does look like a lot of voters turned out, and it definitely looks like it's going to be a landslide. And the results are coming in August 11th. August 10th is the last day for the NLRB to receive the ballots, and then August 11th, they're going to be counted up on a Zoom call where we'll all be present, and we'll be announced if the union is the union is official or not. And again, it looks like it is going to be an official union. It looks like our drive was successful, which is, huge news. Of course, we are, like we see right now, that doesn't mean the work is done. Now it's about the collective bargaining. Now it's about the having a seat at the table. Now it's about like developing the plans and the deals for the protections that will, you know, serve the employees, the guests that we serve, and the larger community. The same thing that's given us this drive to keep going so far, right? Yeah, I mean that's what's happening. We have had a lot of community support. We've had a lot of people turn out and write to the board of directors saying we are in support of our union. We've had a lot of community members and community leaders say we are in support of this union. We are in support of this drive. We hope that there's a fair and free election without interference from the directors. And so far, it's been that way.
I know there's a lot of retaliation going on here at Capitol Hill.
Yes, yeah. So it's always, you always have to keep a constant watchful eye. Right? I mean, we're the same union that Capitol Roots is, SEIU 1199. And what's happening here is, you know, Joseph's House obviously stands in full solidarity with the union and thinks that the union busting going on here is disgusting. I'm glad to be out here as Jay, as from Joseph's House, showing up for Capitol Roots, showing up for the employees and saying, like, we stand in solidarity. We want to get over this hill together because, from what I understand, Amy Klein crossed the line. Yeah. From what I understand, reading what's happened, Amy Klein crossed the line. Right. Yeah.
But like you said, you know, it's a lot of retaliation sometimes.
Yeah.
You have to stay on your toes.
No, yeah, and we are at Joseph's House ready to stay on our toes. And right now we're ready to get to the collective bargaining table and, you know, work out these agreements like officially and, you know, peacefully without, you know,
now,
too
is
much.
If that Zoom count, would that be an open?
That's a good question. And I will have to check back with you.
Okay, yeah,
that's a really good question. I would have to, you know, Sean's over there. I would have to check in with Sean. Sean would be, he's the rep, you know?
Right.
He from SEIU. He'd be the one that I have to ask. That's a really good question.
Right.
I know we'll be allowed to attend, but why not, right? Yeah. It would be a big thing, you know?
Okay.
Hold a Facebook Live, Instagram Live. Get the community involved.
Yeah.
Yeah. Let everyone get in. That
all would right, be great. Jay.
Yeah.
Thank
yeah.
you.
Thank you, Willie. Yeah.
Right. Good luck.
It's always good to, you know, see you, man.
Yeah. Good luck in there. In struggle.
Thank you. We appreciate it. We're obviously, there's, given the environment we're in right now, there's obviously a lot of work to do.
A lot of work.
Yeah. Cool.
Right. That's the way union organizing goes.
Yeah, it's just keep showing up and keep fighting, because, you know, you don't know when this retaliation is going to take shape, right? You don't know when you're going to have to fight harder.
Right.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's right. Listen, every single person who can hear my voice, you are worth more than your boss will ever tell you. If you can hear my voice, you are worth more than media will ever tell you. You are worth more than the fights and the struggles that you have to go through just to survive. Listen, Capitol Roots, Roots United, this is hard work. It's hard work. It's hard work during a hot labor summer, and I know that the Albany County Central Federation of Labor is proud to stand with you workers at Capitol Roots, Roots United. No one deserves the manure that's being dropped on these Roots United. You don't deserve it. You're worth so much more. You are worth so much more. Everybody's already said all the crap that's been going on, so I'm not going to hunker down on that. I'm just going to say, we're proud of you. You should be proud of the hard struggle that you are putting forward every day, and you deserve your union. Check. Keep up the fight.
Stop the endless retaliation and toxic and making the workplace so toxic immediately. And truly recognize their union. Stop trying to carve one or two folks out. Stop pretending that people are supervisors and have all these responsibilities when they can't even send an email without the director's approval.
Thank you. What's disgusting?
Union busting.
What's disgusting?
Union busting.
What's disgusting?
Union
busting. What do we want?
Union.
When do we want it?
Now.
If we don't get.
Shut it down.
If we don't get.
Shut it down.
If we don't get it.
Shut it down.
If we don't get it.
And the Service Employees International Union and local Capital Roots United sponsored this rally. In this part two labor correspondent or labor segment, this audio was a direct recording from the rally.
Braver Angels, a national nonprofit organization, encourages respectful communication among people of different political viewpoints. Local organizers Micah Asbury and William Ernst discussed the group's goals and activities.
As listeners know, we live in a time of extreme divisiveness and growing animosity in political discussion. Today, I'm delighted to have a couple guests who will be telling us about an organization and movement working to cross the divides by encouraging discussion among people of various political beliefs. Joining me today are Bill Ernst and Mike Asbury to talk about the organization Braver Angels. So welcome to Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
Thank you.
Glad to be here.
To start off, perhaps one of you can give us just a small background on what the heck Braver Angels is.
Oh, I'd be happy to give you a little rundown on starting historically. In 2016, there were a few people that got together and began to discuss politics. They were conservatives and they were liberals, and they realized they just couldn't get along very well. So, and this is the short version of the story. They contacted a family counselor, a well-known family counselor, and the family counselor provided them with some principles, which they applied in their discussions, and it worked. There are three men who are considered co-founders of this. And over the years, we have developed into an organization that has now tens of thousands of members who are dues paying, and many more subscribers who subscribe to the channel or to our website. And so from that beginning in 2016, we have grown into 70 alliances across the country, of which the New York Capital Region Alliance, of which Bill and I are members of the steering committee, encompassing 9 counties within the Capital Region area. And we have considerable membership there too.
Perhaps, Bill, you can tell us a little bit about what the goal is and how the organization is structured.
Well, we are a 501c3 organization. We are mostly volunteers. There's a very small paid staff, which happens to be based in New York City. And we are focused on reducing the acrimony, the vitriol that happens between the different sides. And our focus is to promote discussion between people that are diametrically opposed in many instances, and allow them to converse, listen to each other, understand the other person, while not trying to change them or demean them or in any way tear them down, and to foster communication, openness, and mutual trust.
And why is that communication important?
The importance of it is that we've got to bridge the divide between the different sides. We are living in a world in which there are many dangers. And if we are not united in our ideas and overall principles, not specifics, but in the general overall ideas, we are going to be in a very sorry position. I am concerned with the future of our country in the world. And that's the reason that I was able to stumble across, through one of my friends, Braver Angels. And about 7 or 8 months ago, I joined. And I'm working with Mike in the Capital District, where the Capital Region Alliance of Braver Angels to foster friendly, open interchange between the different sides.
You've mentioned discussions. How do you get people together to talk? Is it virtual meetings? Do you have events?
Well, what we do, Bria, is we hold events of various types that are based on protocols established across the nation using those family counseling principles. The website, braverangels.org, describes in some detail what those types of events are. Let me just offer some lead in to what we're proposing lately. We're looking at a town and county official having the focus of the particular question using the attendance of citizens, and the town and county official are of opposite partisan beliefs. We're looking at a local college to have a Braver Angels style debate. These have happened in dozens of colleges across the country. We've done events at local libraries, and we've used, of course, during the pandemic, we've used a lot of Zoom events. The information about where these are is often just easily found by subscribing or becoming a member, because you will get, believe me, you will get emails about where the events occur, whether they're Zoom-based nationally or locally.
I just wanted to add a little bit to what Mike said. We have another type of meeting called the Skills Workshop, in which we let the participants focus on the problems of having a conversation without getting angry and how to discuss hot topics, politics being one of them, without offending the other side, being able to listen to the other side. I first got involved because I had problems with some of my family members who would put their hands over their ears and walk away if, in fact, we started to talk about a political issue of either side. And that's not good for families. It's not good for friends. I also got involved because I have blue-leaning folks that I'm a dancer that I dance with. And I said, man, here we're dancing, we're having a good time, but a subject comes up that's a little bit politically inclined, and they want to walk away and don't talk to you anymore and get off the dance floor. That's what drove me to learn about it, and I liked it, and I've continued to do the things that bring people together rather than spread them apart without hammering on them about their ideas being wrong.
Bria, let me offer some statistics here on the success that we've had. Bill referenced the red, blue, or sometimes the Skills for Bridging the Divide workshop. They're two of our sort of premier and probably a little more challenging events. In the case of the red-blue workshop, we bring reds and blues in the same room together, and in a study done over many events of red-blue workshops from April 20 to April 21, we found that 87% of those attendees gained significant understanding of those across the political divide. 85% felt less estranged or angry with those across the political divide after attending a workshop. And 91% of those attendees see lots of areas of commonality. So it works.
That's terrific. It seems like maybe I should do another segment on this just before Thanksgiving when people are going home to family reunions. You talked about red, blue. I'd like to get a sense of the participants in the membership. Are you open or attractive to people who aren't just red or blue? And how does diversity work, Mike?
Well, it depends on the area you're from. The Albany area is very blue-leaning. In our nine-county alliance, we have about 300 subscribers and around 70 dues-paying members, of which 10% are red-leaning members. But we work very hard in our steering committee and in designing events to include a balance of both red and blues.
Just to add on to that a little bit, we do have, as one of our many different programs, we do have what we call depolarization conversation between races. And that is how to talk about race without getting the other side upset and being an objective and fair in your conversation, eliminating charged words, not setting traps for the other person. That's something that we do as well. We also do it between different ethnicities. Whether it is a gender related type of thing. So we have those types of conversations as part of our program. We haven't had one yet here because we're relatively new in the Capital District. Gender-based discussions between people of different genders or different gender ideas. Those are the types of things, because we have structured, moderated types of discussions to keep people on track and not let them go too far in one direction or another.
Does this just push everybody to central ideas? Does it bring people in toward the center?
Basically, our aim is not specifically to find compromise or centrism. Our aim is to be honest. Our aim is to build a house united. Our aim is about inspiring the beloved community that we know already exists. It's just lost. It's lost in the fray.
So again, this is Bria Barthel talking with Mike Asbury and Bill Ernst of the Capital Region
Alliance
of Braver Angels. Thanks for your work. Thanks for your help. And thanks for the interview.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And for more information, visit braverangels.org or email Michael Asbury directly. That information is on our website at mediasanctuary.org.
The Connect Center is an innovative and creative safe space in Cohoes dedicated to giving tools and resources to local children. In this interview by Dulcia Diggs, she speaks with Executive Director Ben Williams about a recent event and more.
Today, I have Ben Williams, Executive Director of the Connect Youth Center. Ben is here today to discuss his event, Tacos for Life, that took place at the Connect Center on July 8, 2022. Please welcome Mr. Williams. Tell us, how did your event go?
It was a smashing success. We had some celebrity DJs, local DJs, Intel Hayesfield, DJ TGIF, and the one and only DJ Hollywood. They all volunteered to throw a party. I supplied the tacos. Me and the kids made a bunch of tacos, put stations all over the Connect Center so people could explore and connect. We made everybody wear name tags. That was their taco pass. Bottomless tacos. They could go around as many times as they want to and eat whatever they wanted. There was a nacho cheese fountain. There was esports there. There was people in the studio making beats. There was dancing, taco art, taco cupcakes, adopt a taco, just a grand old taco time.
Okay. So adopt a taco. Let's talk about it.
So adopt a taco is our take on a giving tree. So we at the Connect Center made a bunch of paper tacos and made a tree on a wall of different price points and different items that people could purchase and donate to the Connect Center. Anything from feeding a family for a week, all the way up to purchasing computers for the music studio, all the way up to naming rights for certain rooms. It was a great, menu for people to pick and choose on how they really wanted to support the Connect Center. It was pretty good.
Also, to hear more about that summer camp that Mr. Williams just mentioned, go check out our first ever interview with Mr. Williams on mediasanctuary.org. Okay, now, can you please tell us, how does food bring us together? Because it seemed that a lot of your events theme around food. So let's talk about it.
I was a chef in my former life. So there's this immediate link towards food. It's universal, right? It's visceral. The Connect Center, as well as our STEAM-based programming, also does a few food insecurity initiatives. We have a biweekly pantry, as well as a community closet that we make available to the entire community, not just the youth. We also partner with the Regional Food Bank, and we feed 36 families every weekend. These are kids that would depend on school to eat, and I love that program. Sent out over 19,000 meals last school year. I'm really proud of that. We actually honored 11-year-old Richie Ortiz, who him and his father, who owns Ortiz Transport in Cohoes, they're a moving company. They helped us deliver those meals last year. So Richie was our first ever Youth Volunteer of the Year honoree. And that was super special getting to be able to recognize him like that. But yeah, I mean, you know, we operate in a high needs area and, you know, we're fighting poverty at the end of the day. And food is a part of that. For the students to come to my space and be engaged in the programming, they need a full belly. You know, they need to know that they're being provided for. That's part of what we do when they come here. They're allowed to dive into the pantry, get what they need, hygiene products, things of that nature. Yeah, it's just, it's kind of universal. And as far as the fundraiser, it's just fun too. You know, it was fun making a bunch of tacos and experimenting with recipes. It was unlike any other fundraiser I've ever been to. It wasn't stuffy and boring. And, you know, it was a whole party. I think people really responded to that. And we met our fundraising goal and we actually smashed it. And that was the most money we've ever raised at one point. So, you know, it was a great success. And I'm looking forward to the next one in December. It's going to be a biannual fundraiser. So there's going to be one every summer and one every December. Date TBD. You're going to have to stay tuned.
Definitely, definitely. Thank you so much for elaborating on your experience with your fundraiser. I wanted to touch upon, you know, food insecurity, because I'm just curious, you know, it's such a sensitive topic. So with that being said, how do you as a leader and a youth mentor know when a child is not receiving the amount of food they need to receive every single day? Like, what are some typical signs and how do you make sure it's not an embarrassing moment for the child? You know, like, there's a certain way you probably go about it. So you want to explain that process?
You know, for the kids who come to our drop-in program, when they're new to the space, I like to either tour them myself or link them up with a mentor that will show them the facilities and explain to them like, hey, if you need stuff, you can take it at the designated time. We just kind of leave it out there and the kid goes and gets what they need on their own. So that's if they're coming in the door. I also cook with them from time to time. So I'll hold impromptu culinary pop-ups where I'll batch make, you know, a dish with tacos or chili or lasagna or something like that. And I'll just make a bunch and just feed them, you know, and then I'll always give them to-go boxes to take some home for the family, especially if they cooked with me. I like that the kids take pride in cooking the food and they always want to bring some back to their mom or dad and be like, look, I made this, you know. But for our backpack program, we work closely with the school system and the social workers work to refer families to us. It's a little bit of this and that. You know, and it's just the tip of the iceberg. I always want to serve more people and, you know, scale everything. You know, we're moving in a good direction. Our food pantry sees consistent traffic, kids consistently getting stuff from there and the community closet. And like, even over the summer, they'll come back and get free bread. We do like day-end donations with Panera. So we always have some like fresh loaves or baked goods ready for pickup. Yeah, it's just kind of being there and being available. And, you know, that helps to overcome a lot of the stigma. You know, I'm not grilling them about their life or their home life.
More communities need people like you and centers like you, because very rare that you see someone giving food and resources almost 24/7. Like, seems like you're around the clock at this point, would you say?
I'm pretty much here like 7 days a week. So, you know, people stop in whenever, you know, even if we're not programming.
How does the Connect Center for Youth touch each child? It's got to be a certain way going to each child. So how do you, you know, how do you pick how you're going to maneuver with each child? Because I know you can't connect with them all in the same way, perhaps.
I like to ask a lot of questions when they come in, especially when I get you know, exposure. I'll ask a lot of questions around, you know, their interests and their likes, I'm not probing into their family or their financial status or anything. I want to see what motivates them, what really sparks their fire. And then I try to connect them somewhere in the building with the correct programming from there. You know, so I'm kind of like an intake coordinator of sorts. So once they're engaged, they're hooked. And, you know, I love when parents come back and are like, hey, Ben, my kid really loves being there. Like, do you have more? Is there more programming? Can I just leave them there like 24/7? Can you just send them to college? Like, I want to, but that's, you know, that's the sauce for me, is when, you know, the kids love it so much that they're telling other people, they're telling their parents, they're telling their other friends, they're telling their teachers, their community, you know, that's the greatest marketing, and the cheapest marketing is word of mouth. And, you know, and that's how we're building things.
That is a fact. Word of mouth is nothing but gold. I remember when I first heard it, and I was like, when I first started radio, and I was like, no, we do social media these days. And they're like, you know, you got to start learning old school tactics, because they'll never
right. I mean, social media is word of mouth, just digital, you know.
Yeah.
There's stuff that they like.
Yeah.
You know, people are commenting on posts that they like, that they resonate with. It's the same thing, you know, just looks different now.
Right. You know, we all got to adapt. Okay. So when is your next event? Do you have a date on that?
So the next Tacos for Life will be in December. I don't have an official date yet, but again, if you're interested, you can go to connectcenterforyouth.org, sign up for the mailing list. That will let you know about all our events, all of our fall workshops that are coming up for middle and high school age students. We're open to the entire Capital District. If you can get here, you can program. It's all free. The permission slips up there.
Do you have any other events you have that you have on top of your head that may be coming up?
I mean, we're finishing up our summer camps over the next 3 or 4 weeks, and then we move into our fall programming. So our fall programming, I'm really excited for this year. We're going to launch in esports, but we're getting into competitive gaming, and there's going to be a whole bunch of, you know, STEAM-based workshops this fall in conjunction with different universities, different organizations.
This is Dulcinea Dix with Hudson Mohawk Magazine, and I just spoke with Mr. Williams. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Dulce. Appreciate you.
Adopt a Taco and pop-up food events are great fundraisers for the Connect Center in Cohoes. Our thanks to Dulcinea Diggs and Executive Director Ben Williams. And that's our show. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Andrea Cunliffe.
And I'm Jacob Boston. Our engineer is Sina Bazila Hickey.
And Jacob Boston.
I helped a little bit too. We want to thank all of our volunteers who made this episode possible. Contributors to today's episode are Dulcinea Diggs, Brea Barthel, Willie Terry, Mark Dunley, Steve Pierce, Andrea Cunliffe, and yours truly, Jacob Boston, once again.
So tune in every weekday at 7 a.m., 9 a.m., and 6 p.m. to hear local news or stream Sanctuary Radio at mediasanctuary.org. Full episodes and individual stories are available on demand at our website, and on your favorite podcast platform. We appreciate you listening. So until next time, folks.